Thank you for joining us for this episode of ZB Talk, a production of the Zeta Beta Tau Foundation.
This podcast was created to highlight some of the many amazing stories about the brothers of Zeta Beta Tau fraternity.
We, the brothers of Zeta Beta Tau fraternity, believe that the development of the individual as a responsible, mature member of society is the primary goal of the university today.
We believe that fraternity offers to the university community a unique, desirable, and successful means of achieving this goal.
In fulfilling the purposes of fraternity, we dedicate ourselves to the principles of intellectual awareness, social responsibility, integrity, and brotherly love.
What's the hour?
It must be time for ZB Talk. This is Farron Lewitt, Psi University of Alabama, 1997.
And Jonathan H. Levin, Alpha Kappa, University of Wisconsin, 2002.
We're your hosts for this episode of ZB Talk. Our guest today is John Pessa, Epsilon of Phi Sigma Delta Fraternity at the University of Maryland, College Park, 1974, who is a 46-year sports journalism veteran who recently published his second book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask.
Thanks for joining us, John.
It's a pleasure to be here, guys.
So why don't you tell our listeners, how did you get into sports journalism?
Well, that's an interesting story. I went to the University of Maryland to major in engineering. And they tell you in engineering that to look in front and behind you and on both sides. And if you're here 4 years from now, they won't be. And after 8 weeks, I came in and said, don't worry about me. I'm not one of those. And then went to the well-worn path to the business school and didn't like that. And, just, you know, thought, geez, what do I really want to do? What do I really like? And I love to write. And I joined the school newspaper, the Diamondback. And I always knew it was going to be sports, even though I didn't tell my parents that at the time. And I walked in and met the sports editor who ended up being my brother-in-law many, many years later, and covered the Len Elmore, Tom McMillan, John Lucas, Lefty Driesell coached Maryland team that was super exciting. And that just, you know, I just fell in love with journalism and I knew that that's just what I wanted to do the rest of my life.
So as a sports journalist and author, you've probably obviously interviewed a number of people. Who's your, best interview what was the best question you've ever asked?
Wow, that's a hard one. I'll tell you what. I mean, I've interviewed, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people at this point, and for in all different settings. And it's hard to kind of pick one, but I'll tell you one that really sticks in my mind is one with Rob Manfred, who at the time was the deputy commissioner. Bud Selig was still commissioner, and it was in 2011. And I had written a column for the New York Times, about the labor negotiations in baseball. And what made that stand out was that in that calendar year, football, basketball, hockey, and baseball, all their contracts came up, and the only sport not to have a labor stoppage was baseball. And baseball was famous for having labor stoppages. So the New York Times asked me to write why. And I basically wrote that synopsis of my book, because that really was what my first book was about. And in it, I said two things about Bud Selig that were very different. One was that he was, belonged in the Hall of Fame. And the other was that he had to learn that he had to stop trying to break the union. And it just so happened that I had an interview set up with Rob Manfred the next day. And the day after it came out. And after spending an hour on the phone with Bud Selig, who didn't like what I wrote, I knew that the interview with Rob Manfred would be a lot of fun. And I walked into his office, and he had my column up on his laptop behind his desk and his desktop in front of him in two different places. And the minute I walked in the door and sat down, he started just screaming at me, literally shouting at me about, if this is the garbage that we're going to have to put up with, I don't even know why I'm talking to you, on and on and on like that. And I just said, Rob, I'm here. You want to discuss the subject? Let's discuss it. And we talked for about an hour and a half. And at the end of it, he was fine. But those are the kind of conversations, and those are the kind of interviews that really are the most fun and the most challenging.
So you obviously referenced that you've had a ton of interviews, met a lot of people. So who have you really appreciated having had the opportunity to meet as a result of your work, and why?
That's another good question. I'll tell you what, a person who really jumps out in my mind was the athletic director at Duke University. His name was Tom Butters, and the athletic building there is named after him. And he was a visionary. He was one of the first people to see and to get college basketball on television. I mean, I remember watching UCLA win championships on tape delay because nobody broadcasted college basketball. And this is one of the guys who understood the value of college basketball as an entertainment product and got it on television. And he was really an impressive man. And I interviewed him for a profile I did on Mike Krzyzewski, which turned out to be kind of a controversial profile. And I have the way I start most interviews is I tell people that, let's start on background. And what that means is that I can use the material that they tell me. I won't attribute it to them, nor will I reveal that I've ever talked to them. So it kind of establishes a basis of trust. And when we sat down, I told him that, let's talk on background. He was very media savvy, and he understood what that was. And he looked at me and he said, young man, if I don't want you to know something, I'm just not going to tell you. So anything else I say, you can is on the record. And that was just so refreshing and it's always stuck in my mind. And we talked for 2.5 hours about everything about Mike Krzyzewski and Duke, told me some wonderful stories. And I just, that was just one of my favorite interviews. And the way it started was just so unique for me. Because most people, don't want to be quoted, especially on controversial subjects. And one of the subjects that he and I discussed was Mike Krzyzewski's decision not to talk about the Duke lacrosse case when three of the kids were accused of raping a young Black woman, an accusation that turned out not to be true. And a lot of people didn't want to talk about that. And he talked about it on the record, and it was a guy that I walked away from going, really having a lot of admiration for. So I'd have to say that's the person. His name is Tom Butters.
It's great. So you've done so much in your 46-year career thus far, and curious if you could compare and contrast writing books, which you've done recently, with being an editor at a newspaper like the Hartford Current or Newsday or a magazine like ESPN, the magazine?
Wow. I mean, all three very, very different. I'd loved my 20 years in newspapering. My big break was getting a job at the Washington Star, 10 miles down the road from the University of Maryland, but 5 years after I started in journalism. And that's when I made the switch from being a writer to being an editor, and just absolutely fell in love with the editing process and having a chance to tell a big story every day, which was what happened in the sports world today. And for some reason, being a layout editor, which is what I was primarily, was the road to being a sports editor. And I became a sports editor, which on top of being an editor meant managing people, and at 35 managing a group of people, many of them older than me, was really interesting and quite a challenge. And we went from a staff of, my staff when I started was 17 and people, and I left with a staff of 54 full-time people and 30 hour part-time people. And then went to Newsday, and that was a huge challenge, being in the biggest market in the country. And that, I was there for a couple of years, like 3 years, before a friend of mine called me and asked me if I wanted to help him start ESPN Magazine. And that was a risk, because, starting up anything, but I figured that those four letters, that we would have to really screw up a product to not make it work. But it ended up taking 4 years to get that off the ground. And that was an incredibly difficult and exciting thing to do. And the magazine itself was, very successful from the start. We hit 1 million subscribers within the first year. And magazine journalism was so different from sports, from newspaper. Having a little bit more time, the demands of how deep you can go, was exponentially higher than it was on the newspaper. And I did that for 15 years, ended up with running the investigative team there, which is really what I love doing the best. And we did a big project on the rise of steroids in baseball. And that was exciting, and it was difficult and a lot of fun. And a book agent approached me and thought that I should think about writing books. And I thought that I had done a lot of hard things in my career. And I got to tell you that writing books dwarfs anything I've ever done. It is immensely difficult. Everybody says that they would like to write a book, and I think it's a great thing to do. But it's one of those things sometimes is to be careful what you wish for. My first book took me 5 years to finish, and this one took me 4.5. You have to have an awful lot of discipline, because you're basically your own boss. And, it's like, how much time do you want to spend digging out the stories to make a good book? And I spend an awful lot of time, so much so that my wife started referring to herself as a book widow, and went back to acting for several years, and then became and is now an expert quilter, something she had never done in her life. But she kind of lost a husband there for great stretches of time, and that's how she filled it. So it puts a huge strain on your family life, but when it's done, it feels awfully good.
That's great. So you've written pretty extensively about this, but how has money negatively and positively impacted sports?
Wow. I'll tell you what, I think negatively, I think it has made sports fans feel much more entitled to criticize players. And by criticize, I mean, just really the things that I read that people say about athletes when I listen to talk radio, and especially with baseball. Which is interesting. And I've spent a lot of time writing about baseball, and I've talked to, a lot of baseball players in the union about this. And I think that most people look at pro football and realize they'll never be big enough and strong enough to be able to play pro football. And you look at basketball and it's like, okay, I'm not 6'8". I'm not 245 pounds. There's no way I'm ever going to play pro basketball. But then you look at baseball and you see people like David Wells, who is probably about 25 pounds overweight. You see a guy like Jose Altuve, who's maybe 5'5". You see people of all shapes and sizes, and you think that, hey, you know what? I can strike out with the bases loaded too. And, you know, so I think that, people, you know, having listened for 46 years from the inside to people, the criticizing of baseball players is the most harsh. And I think that, there's a resentment factor for what people, you know, how much baseball players earned. I think we really heard that in the negotiations about whether to play this season or not, and saying, you know, people are out of work and they're offering you, you know, $6 million to play baseball. How dare you not play baseball? Stuff like that. It's also changed the dynamic between the press and players. I had a guy who worked for me at the Hartford Courant who was a baseball writer in the 60s, and he would tell me that at the end of every season, the baseball players would cozy up to him to write nice things about them because they wanted to get a job in town in the off season, because baseball players used to have to work in the off season to be able to have enough money to live on. And now you're talking about people who make more money than you and I will ever imagine making, and they live in a completely different life than we do. And it's really changed the dynamic about how the media and the sports figures interact.
So you were a sports editor at the Hartford Courant, where you and your team were nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for an examination into the role of racism in Major League Baseball, and curious as to your thoughts on how baseball has changed since then. And I think our listeners would be interested to know exactly how you went about examining the role racism had in Major League Baseball.
Well, I'll take the second part first. And the idea to do this, that project came from a woman who became my best friend, and she worked as a baseball writer on that staff. Her name is Claire Smith. She was the 2017 Spinks Award winner to enter the Hall of Fame and in the writer's ring. And she's also African-American. And she felt it was really important for us to examine why there were the number of African-American players were shrinking, and why there were so few, if any, managers, and also key positions like catcher, even back then, that there weren't many black catchers thought to be not smart enough to catch, and you know, and clearly the front office, and it was, you know, like any delicate story, it's a matter of spending the time to gain people's trust. There'll be many times where I will go in to do difficult stories and will sit with people who I'm interviewing with or interviewing, and never really ask any of the questions about the story. It's mostly questions about, you know, growing up and what your last job was like, and just and things, so that we could just establish a personal relationship, and a relationship that's based on trust. And that's really the, you know, to do those kinds of stories, you have to lay the groundwork of trust and mutual trust before you could ever get at something as sensitive as race, and having people talk to you. And it's also a matter of finding the leaders and the people who other players respect. And one of the people that was key in that project was the late Don Baylor, who was a terrific player and an even better man, and had the respect of every player in baseball. And, you know, once we got him to cooperate and people saw that he trusted us, then other players trusted us. And that's kind of how you go about doing that, a story like that. As far as how things have changed, I wish I could say they had improved greatly, but if you look at front offices, you don't see a lot of African-Americans in the front office or in ownership. And I think at this point, the African-American participation in Major League Baseball is between 7 and 8% of baseball players. And it once was 35%. So I can't say that things have changed all that much for the better on that front.
Wow.
Interesting. Well, over your 46-year career in sports journalism, what has changed the most about your profession?
Well, the way the profession is done now is profoundly different than the way it used to be done, and that is a function of social media, and also the economics of the media. I mean, when I was a writer working at a newspaper, my job was to go and write a story. And now, if you're a writer at a newspaper, you write a story, you do a podcast, you do interviews, video interviews that you put online, and your job back then, your job was always 24 hours, but you only had one deadline or two deadlines for editions of a newspaper. But now your deadline is around the clock. If something breaks, you're expected to react and react fast. And one of the things that really struck me as things started changing, and as you say, I've been doing this for 46 years, so I've got experience in different eras of this game. And when things really started shifting to away from traditional newspapers and more for news online, and people would call me to do freelance pieces. And when one of the things they told me was, don't worry about getting it, getting everything right the first time. We can always correct it because it's the internet. And it's like no, we kind of, you never want to make, you don't go in thinking that, all right, you can just do half the story because you have to get it in. But that's really, the immediacy of social media has made people rush stories into online that they might not have all the entire story, and they might not be right, but the pressure to be first, which was always part of the game, but the pressure to be first now and the ability to be out there immediately has really, really changed what the job is like and how the job is done. And I wish it was for the better, but I see way too many mistakes. I see way too many incomplete stories. And I just don't think that's a good thing.
Sure. So we'll go back a bit further than your 46 year career in history and go back to ancient times. And standing in the Roman Colosseum or the Circus Maximus, you can't really help but think about sport in ancient times. And it's obviously much different in today's stadiums and arenas. In looking at specifically the fans, how have the fans of sport remained the same or changed since the days of the Roman gladiator?
Well, it's interesting. I think that people have always, I've been a sports fan all my life, and my earliest memory is being 4 years old, being behind my apartment building, and my father pitching to me. And of course, he had me in pinstripes since he was a Yankee fan and we lived in New York. And I think people have always lived vicariously through athletes. And I think people have always, and this puts a lot of pressure on athletes, taking their lead from athletes in terms of values. We expect these people to be good people. We expect them to set a great example for younger people. And I think that's something that has, that started that way. And I think Greek, the athletes that were in the Olympics were looked upon as heroes and looked upon as people who were, set an example about how we, how we want to live our lives. And I think that pressure has, and that feeling has been present all through history and, right up until this very day.
How did the idea for your first book, The Game, Inside the Secret World of Major League Baseball's Power Brokers, come about? And John, how did you go about writing it?
It came about, I wanted to write about Let me try that again. I wanted to write about baseball. This is my favorite sport. And there was so much that had gone on in the last 25 years. I picked that story up in the early 90s, and you know, which is really I was pretty deep into my career. And you know, as we talked about, baseball was always going on strike and or having lockouts. And it has such a profound effect on my life, and I think it has a profound effect on a lot of people's lives. We had gone through all the labor wars, and then that kind of merged into the steroid wars scandal, and you know, and how that the rise of steroids and how people dealt with it. And I wanted to tell this, the story through a couple of different perspectives. Major League ownership, which really has evolved over the years, and the players' union, and what the rise of free agency and the role of drugs there, and the New York Yankees, who sets the salary scale. So I ended up almost making it a biography of Bud Selig, who represented the owners, and Don Fehr, who represented the players' union, and George Steinbrenner. And how I went about doing that was you always got to, this book was always going to be contentious because the labor negotiations and the steroid scandal was pretty contentious. And so you're looking at, so who will be invested in this book? And the first group of people who really wanted me to do this book was the Players Union. And they were Michael Weiner, who sadly passed away late in my reporting on this story from brain cancer at the age of 51, one of the nicest and smartest people I've ever met. And he decided that the union had never been well represented in the media. So he was invested and he wanted to do this book. And for 4 years, we talked on a regular basis about how the union evolved and how it dealt with everything from free agency and negotiating with the players to with the owners, to how it handled the drugs and how it handled Congress. Because if you remember, Congress, in 2005, I believe, with the hearings referred to as the Mark McGuire hearings about investigating steroids in baseball, as if nothing else in the country was more important during those days. And once they bought in, the Yankees always were cooperative, and then Major League Baseball, which was reluctant to do it, but if the union was going to present its side of the story, then they were compelled to tell their side of the story. So it was a matter of, finding the people that trust you and investing an awful lot of time. And as I said, that one took me 5 years to write, and weaving three different people's story and doing it in chronological order was kind of a challenge, but it turned out to be a New York Times bestseller. So I guess it worked out pretty well.
Very well. And you said it took you 5 years. So hopefully you learned a little bit along the way. So curious as to what you did differently with the second book, Yogi, A Life Behind the Mask, based on what you learned from writing the first.
Well, I really wish I would have learned a lot more about how to write shorter and quicker. What I discovered pretty early in the process was that writing a biography of one person was going to be very, very different than writing a book that dealt a lot with issues. And it was also, the first book started in 1992, and in 1992, I was 40 years old. So I had covered a lot of what went on. I was obviously alive during the time of this book. So I knew the context of everything that happened in this book. Yogi Berra was born in 1925, the same year as my father. He lived through a depression. He fought in World War II. He played in the 1950s when there were three baseball teams in New York. All of these things that I have no experience with. So trying to understand what life was like for Yogi and what life was like in America for those years was was the challenge of this book. And I got lucky in finding three men who grew up with Yogi Berra on the hill in St. Louis. And they were all 90 years old, and Yogi lived to be 90 and led along a fruitful life. And they were terrific in talking to me about what life was like growing up, both in the Italian Quarter of St. Louis, but in the Depression and going off to war. And Yogi's sister-in-law, Carmen Berra, and Yogi were married for 65 years, and they met in 1947. And his sister-in-law Bonnie, who still is alive and in her 90s and doing very well, and she just became an incredibly good source of what life was like as a professional athlete through the for his entire career, since she had such a very, very close relationship with her sister and with Yogi. There were many baseball players from my youth, which was really interesting, meeting Al Downing, who I grew up watching pitch for the Yankees, and Ralph Terry, who every Yankee fan in New York who grew up when I did hated Ralph Terry because he gave up the pitch to Bill Mazeroski that lost the World Series for the Yankees in 1960. And I ended up spending a day with Ralph Terry when he was in New York for an old-timers game, and he turned out to be one of the nicest people I've ever met and was just a terrific source. And, same thing with Darn Larson and, meeting some of the old players like Bobby Brown, who was Yogi's first roommate, who was terrific in filling in what the late 40s and the 50s were like. And Darn Larson about what pitching a perfect game with Yogi Berra was like. So there were no shortage of people to talk with. The more, it's sort of like a case of the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And there's just so many people out there. And Yogi, a lot of people knew Yogi and loved Yogi and felt like I talked to about 150 people to do this book. And I did manage to cut about 6 months off the time. So I finished this book in 4.5 years.
Wow, what a fascinating topic. And talking about fraternity, fraternity teaches leadership. And how was Yogi a leader on and off the field?
Well, I'll tell you what, on the field, Yogi was a very, very take charge, verbal leader. As a catcher, it's the only position that, that sees the entire field. It's the only position that when the ball is hit, he has to know what every single player on the field is supposed to be doing. And he deals with the most high-strung people on the team, and that's the pitching staff, and he's almost a psychologist. So, and he was referred to by Casey Stengel as his assistant manager, and he pretty much was the assistant manager on the Yankees. And he was the one who ran the pitching staff. He's the one who met with the pitchers before games, not Casey Stengel. And so he really was the leader on the field. And this terrific story that I have to tell if you have the time about Mickey Mantle, this happened around 1957-58, and Yogi was very, very popular in the press, and Mantle was always booed by the fans, but also obviously very famous and very popular. But he, it's like, why is Yogi always getting all this attention? He plays catcher. What's the big deal about that? So they actually, Whitey Ford pitched, and they actually came up with a system where Mickey Mantle called the game instead of Yogi Berra, where, if he put his hands on his knees, it was a curveball. If he stood up straight in center field, it was a fastball, and he called the game. And it got to be the seventh inning, and the Yankees went 2-0. And by the time At the end of the seventh inning, he came into the dugout and he was just a nervous wreck. And he said, "That's it. I can't take this pressure. We could lose this game if I call the wrong pitch. Yogi, it's back to you. I'll never say anything bad about you again." And that, you know, that's, you know, you really, really have to be a leader to be a catcher. Off the field, I think Yogi was much more quiet and led by example. And one of the greatest examples of that Yogi, you know, said was that Yogi did never big time people. Yogi, I mean, was one of the biggest celebrities in America. I mean, he was a television star. He did television shows. He was did cameos in radio, in movies. He was on commercials. He was in print ads. I mean, he was about as famous as you got in the 50s. And he was, if you met him, he was just a normal person. You would never know he was a star. You would never know he was rich. He was just, you know, he was as comfortable in this story in the book about him going to a state dinner that Ronald Reagan had for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And Yogi sat at the head table with Reagan and the Crown Prince, and he was comfortable with them. And when you go into the New York Yankee locker room, you'd see Yogi hanging out with the security guards and the clubhouse men. He was his fame did not change who he was. And he was always just a good person. And that's the kind of, example, that he set. And I think that's, you know, and says an awful lot about who Yogi was.
So during Yogi's life, he faced some difficulties and challenges, including discrimination, substance abuse within his family, and a number of other ways. Please share some of those and how they impacted who Yogi was.
Yeah, you know, I didn't realize that being born in 1952, the amount of racism and discrimination that Italian Americans felt in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, you know, even, you know, going into the 60s. And, you know, so he got a lot of verbal abuse, especially in the minor leagues, for being Italian. And you know, he was also looked at as an odd looking person. And the way he spoke, people mocked the tone. People thought that he was not terribly smart. He was called by fans, by players, by the media as the ugliest man in baseball. There was a headline over a column by Arthur Daly, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner, and it called the headline of the column on Yogi Berra was "Nature Boy." He was called Quasimodo. He was called the ape by his manager and teammates and opponents. People would hang on the dugout, top of the dugout, and, you know, by one arm and scratch under their other arm, acting like a monkey when he came up to bat. People would throw bananas on the field. You know, the kind of abuse that Jackie Robinson felt, Yogi didn't get as much, but it was in that sort of territory, which was something I had no idea that he faced, certainly to the degree that I discovered that he faced. And one of the things that really had an impact on me and I wrote about in the book was, you would think that somebody who faced that kind of verbal abuse could easily come out as a bitter person. And yet Yogi turned out to be just a real sweetheart of a man. So he was able to, you know, get through that. The personal challenge of the drug abuse by his youngest son, Dale Berra, who was also a very good baseball player, was drafted in the first round, number 20, by the Pirates. Made it to the major leagues at 20, which was a year earlier than his father did. And but in the late, you know, in the mid to late 80s, cocaine was something that was very popular in the United States, and especially among successful young, successful people. And, you know, being a baseball player, making $300,000-$500,000 a year with plenty of free time, he kind of fell into a group in Pittsburgh that got involved with cocaine. And that became a very big story in the United States. It was the Pittsburgh drug trials. And I think there were 13 baseball players in all who ended up choosing a fine or a suspension. And that it was doubly tough on Dale because his father was one of the most famous baseball players in history. And it's a cocaine is a incredibly addictive drug, one that's very difficult to kick. He was got a lot of support from his family, but in 1989, he was picked up as part of a big drug ring in New Jersey of 25 people, and you know, again went through a substance abuse program. And, you know, again, his family supported him. But in 1992, a friend of the Bearers called and told him that Dale had been at a party and he was doing cocaine again. And this time Yogi called a family meeting, and there he has three sons, and the two older sons got there first. And when Dale walked in, the entire family was there, and Yogi walked up to him and said that, we love you. We support you. We'll do everything we can to help you. But if this continues, you're no longer part of the Berra family. And that was the end of Dale's drug use. And then he ended up starting a, him and his middle brother, Tim, ended up starting a memorabilia business, marketing Yogi, that that turned out to be a terrific business for them, and that's what they did for the rest of their life. And the time that Yogi did not spend with his kids when they were growing up because of always being away playing baseball, he ended up spending in the last, you know, 20, 30 years of his life, which was really nice for him.
Yeah, that's great. So what are your favorite Yogiisms and why?
I mean, there are so many, and the ones that I like the best are the ones that that you know, there's an underlying truth to them. And you know, one of the sweetest ones, where when he talks about his wife, and they were married again for 65 years, he goes, you know, we enjoy doing things together even when we're not together. And, you know, that one always gets me. Clearly, it ain't over till it's over, which everyone uses in sports now, was a great one. When you come to the fork in the road, take it, which is, you know, if you don't know the story behind it, sounds, you know, funny. But actually there's a, if you go to where he was talking about and you hit the fork in the road, which they literally, it's in Montclair, New Jersey, and they literally have a stone with the saying carved in, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. And what it turns out to be is a circular road that when you get to either way you go, you still end up on the same road, and that's the road where Yogi's house was. So that one made sense. When he was asked how the Yankees could possibly lose to the Pirates after outscoring them something like 92-40 in the 1960 World Series, he said, "We made too many wrong mistakes." And of course, what he was saying was, we made, you know, they capitalized on the mistakes that we made. But it sounded funny, but it made a lot of sense. And then probably the one I like the best, because it so encapsulates Yogi, is, "I never said everything that I said." And, you know, writers took a little liberty with, especially in the early going with Yogi, if something sounded like Yogi said it, it became a Yogiism, whether he said it or not. So I'd say there's probably a good 10-15% of things that are attributed to Yogi that he didn't say. But one of the most interesting things about Yogi is that he had an eighth grade education, and there are 8 quotes from him in Bartlett's famous quotations, which is more than any president of the United States.
Wow.
Interesting.
So Can you describe for our listeners what happened at the Copacabana and how Yogi felt about it years later?
Sure. The Copacabana Club was, you know, one of the most famous nightclubs in New York City. And this is 1957. And the Yankees are go out to celebrate Billy Martin's birthday. So it was Whitey Ford and his wife, and Mickey Mantle and his wife, and Hank Bauer and his wife. Yogi was, you know, they wanted Yogi to go, and Yogi didn't want to go. And Yogi was, this is in May, and Yogi is hitting 167. He's in one of the worst slumps of his career, and he doesn't want to go. But Carmen, who loved to party in New York, but also thought that this would relax her husband and hopefully get him on back on track hitting, convinced him to go. And they went, and there ended up becoming a fight. There was a group of bowlers who were heckling Sammy Davis Jr. And there's a lot of versions of the story, but all we know is that there was a fight in the bathroom and that one of the bowlers ended up on the floor with a broken nose. And Hank Bauer was accused of punching him in the face, although those charges were dropped. As you might imagine, it was a giant story that was in the media. It cost every player on the Yankees $200. And in 1957, $200 was a big deal. And it was embarrassing. Yogi was very embarrassed about being involved in something like that. And his wife always felt guilty, because if she hadn't convinced Yogi to go, Yogi would have been home sleeping instead of being involved in an incident that was a hugely embarrassing one for everybody involved.
So you had mentioned that one of the Yogi-isms is that we made too many wrong mistakes. And one of the reasons I believe the fraternity experience is so educational and important is when it's done right, that it provides a safe environment for our undergraduate brothers to make mistakes. They learn from those mistakes, and they have brothers there while the mistakes are being made to confront them when the actual mistakes are occurring, and make sure that it doesn't get to the point where there's no return. Nowhere else on a college campus can an 18, 19, or 20-year-old young man lead an organization like a fraternity, dealing with budgets, sometimes in the hundreds of thousands of dollars or even more. They do event planning, hiring, firing staff, consensus building, maintaining a physical plan in the chapter house, public speaking, running meetings, and I could go on and on. Mistakes are when we learn the most. Curious about your fraternity experience, and we don't necessarily have to get into any of the mistakes, but would like to hear about your experience in Epsilon.
I'll tell you what. I couldn't imagine what my 4 years at Maryland would have been like outside of being involved in my fraternity. It just became my family. And my best friends from college were all people that I spent, 2, 3, 4 years with. Many of whom I still speak with and know today. And it was such a formative, it was so good. I mean, you know, first time away from home, first time ever on an airplane was flying down to University of Maryland to go to school, and to have people there, some of whom were assigned to look out for you, was just such an advantage to put you in an environment which was so foreign but so comfortable because of that. And there was just so many great memories, and I'll never forget half of the fraternity was from the Maryland Baltimore area, and half of the fraternity was from the New Jersey New York area. And one of the things I'll always remember was when the Colts were in the Super Bowl, and the kicker, whose name I believe was Jim O'Brien, was about to make the kick for the field goal that would win the Super Bowl. Just as he was approaching the ball to kick it, one of the fraternity brothers from New Jersey flipped the circuit switch, so the TV went out. And the and all the Colt fans went crazy. But of course, they were happy since the Colts, he ended up winning. But, you know, we did fun things like that. The fact that, you know, you're in a class right from the start, and there's 14, 15 people that you're just bonded with. I still, you know, I just got an email from my, you know, Vince, and who just was, you know, an indelible person. Even though I haven't spoken to him sometimes in years and years, I'll just always remember the effect he had on my life. And I ended up my last year there working the kitchen, serving, you know, making money to be able to afford things on campus. So all 4 years, I was always part of the fraternity, playing basketball in the hoop in the back, learning basketball from the players there that were better than me. There was just so much that that was good. And like I said, I just couldn't imagine what my 4 years there would have been like without the fraternity. And I'm just really glad that I ended up in the fraternity.
That's great. So it's going back to the book. What is your favorite part of the Yogi book, and what was left on the cutting room floor, so to speak, that you wish you had included in it?
Well, I'll tell you, there's two things that come to mind. This book is, this book is 506 pages long. I'm told that it reads fast because it's all scenes and dialogue. It's not written as a traditional biography. It reads more like a novel, because that's the way I think it's the most entertaining and interesting way to write. But I ended up cutting 60 pages out of this book. And the one that probably hurt the most, and it was the last one that got cut, was a story about Jackie Robinson, which at that point in the book was tangential to Yogi, because they ended up being great friends and huge rivals in the 50s in New York. They always met in the World Series. And Jackie Robinson, while Yogi was off, you know, in 1944 at D-Day, Jackie Robinson was one of the few officers, black officers in the army. And he was at Fort Hood in Texas, and it was known as one of the absolute worst places for African Americans. Very, very racist at the time. And he got into a situation where he got on a bus. He sat in the middle of the bus. The bus driver told him, in no uncertain terms and using certain words, that he wasn't allowed to sit there, and told him to get in the back. And Jackie said no. And long story short, he was brought up on 6 charges to be court-martialed. And he got off on every one of them. And that changed baseball history, in one way that it could have, which is, had he been court-martialed, Brent Rickey never would have been able to bring Jackie Robinson in to break the color barrier in baseball. And had that incident not happened, Jackie Robinson was considering a career in the Army. He was very involved in civil rights, and he and Joe Louis, the boxing champion, were one of the few officers, black officers, as I've said, and he was thinking about staying in the Army and helping to integrate the Army. But after that incident, he decided to leave the Army when his tour was over, and obviously then came into baseball and broke the color barrier. The story that one of the stories that stuck with me the most was towards the end of the book, there's a section that's called Friends of Yogi, and it's about 8 different vignettes of different people in his life, from Ron Guidry, and who used to cook frog legs for Yogi, to the woman who helped start whose idea it was to start the Yogi Berra Museum. But the one that really stuck with me, and even though I wrote it, it still makes me cry every time I read it, was and I might not get through telling you about it right now, but Phil Rizzuto became Yogi's best friend from the day they met in 1947 when Yogi was a rookie. And he was the one who convinced him to move to New Jersey, and he was his business partner in a bowling alley and several other things, and they were very, very close. And I believe it was 2007, and where Phil was in very bad health, and Yogi would visit him every Wednesday at the nursing home, and the two of them just sat there. It always gets me just thinking about it. It was very, very warm friendship, and the scene of Phil knowing he was about to die and Yogi being there with him just really stuck with me, and it still does to this day.
So we've got one more final question, and I think we've got a 46-year sports journalism veteran. I would be kicking myself if we didn't ask. I've got two words and want your response to the two words, and the two words are Pete and Rose.
Not in the Hall of Fame.
Not in the Hall of Fame. Care to expand on that?
Sure. Okay, and I'll start with this. Roger Clemens should be in the Hall of Fame. Barry Bonds should be in the Hall of Fame. There are people, there are players that everyone knows use steroids that are in the Hall of Fame. It was part of the game. There were players, Steve Phillips, who was the general manager of the Mets, told me that, during that era, he thought it was 3 to 5 players who were using steroids. He said, you know what, it turned out that it was more like 10 to 15 players per team that were using steroids. An all-star pitcher turned to me one day and he said, anybody who tells you they didn't know who was using steroids was lying, because you could see the poison coming out of their body, and which he meant the acne field that you got when you cycled on and off steroids. There was just, steroids was part of the culture of the game. To single out an angry black man and a redneck from Texas as the fall guys for steroids, to take the shift the blame from management, let's say, who did get into Hall of Fame, like Bud Selig, who presided over the game, and the managers whose players made them World Series champions or in the Hall of Fame. I just think that it's completely unfair to say that the players who literally were the ones who put their lives on the line, because who knows how steroids really affect you, shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. On the other hand, in every major league locker room, you see a sign that says there are no betting in baseball. And, to bet on a game in baseball is wrong and against everything that you're supposed to be. But if you're the manager and you're betting on your own team, that just completely undermines the integrity of the game. How can I believe, watching any game that Pete Rose managed, that he didn't make decisions based on where he placed the bet? And then he lied about it for, 10, 12 years, denying that he did it and then finally admitting that he did it? I'm sorry. I just don't see how you can possibly put, someone who did those things into the Hall of Fame.
Understood. Well, Brother Pessa, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. You provide a wonderful example for our brothers, and it ain't over till it's over.
Thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. Anytime.
And our thanks to Hunter Lang, Gamma Mu, University of Memphis, 2013, for our music and production support.
And as always, it's great to be a ZBT, and it's now over.